Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 29, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleform conference call. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleform conference call. As today, we discuss the Friedrichs labor law case, a decision handed down earlier today by the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back return guest to our program, Professor Richard A. Epstein. He's the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law. He's also a Hoover Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and a Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, he is here as a long-term friend of the Federalist Society. He's going to give us some background comments on the case and the decision, 10 to 12 minutes or so. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Epstein, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Dean. It's a happy occasion to be able to talk to various people about a very difficult case. It's a sad occasion to have to do it because this is the first decision that has been issued, or not issued as the case may be, since the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Everybody who heard the oral argument was perfectly clear that the vote was 5-4. It is now a 4-4 deadlock, and so we do not get the opinion of the majority. We do not get the opinion of the dissent. Because there are none of those things, we get a one-sentence line, and there's no reason for me to try to parse it for you. It's also clear in terms of news that the organization involved in this thing is basically going to decide that they're going to push this case forward for a rehearing. This would be Terry Pell, the president for the Center of Individual Rights, who issued a statement today about how the court was split on union fees and how it was that he would try to get this thing resolved, obviously in his favor, once it came out. There were some things in this statement which actually I did not quite know, and it was a good statement. He says, you know, California teachers pay about $650 a year in agency stop, but given that they're agency players, they lose benefits like maternity leave, disability, and professional life insurance, which sort of indicates to you the following very simple point. If there are people who are prepared to opt out of the union, it's clear that when they do so opt out of the union, that they are paying serious costs for that. And so it would be a mistake, I think, to think of this simply as an economic decision. It's also a decision that many of the people who are teaching are not, in fact, people who believe that what the union says or what the union does is consistent with their own sets of responsibility as to how government relationships ought to be organized with respect to unions. And now, at this particular point, there's nothing you can do to analyze the opinion as such because there is none. But it's interesting to sort of go back and to reflect upon the pattern of argumentations here, because it sort of shows the sort of opportunistic nature of the way in which people on both sides of the issue tend to think about many of the issues. So the first point that sort of comes up in this particular case is the extent to which the doctrine of stare decisis really ought to govern under these particular circumstances. The reason why it's so important is that there was a very thorough consideration of this entire issue in a case called Abood against the Detroit Department of Education, and I think it was 1977, in which Potter Stewart, who is very much a centrist judge, thinks that he could maintain the line which says that teachers in an agency shop situation could not be required to contribute to political causes that were run by the unions, but they could be required to contribute to those things which involved economic issues. And he thought that the line between these two groups was particularly stable. And back in 1977, when I think it's fair to say that unions were political, but much less politically active than they were today, you might be able to see some degree of daylight going between these two areas. What is also clear is as the world has started to move on, the efforts of unions to continue to push very hard for strong benefits is in fact more conspicuous now than it was 40 years ago. The sort of cutting edge issue on this particular point is, I think, without question, the issues of work rules on the one hand and on pension benefits with respect to the other. So you've got two very large issues here. It's quite clear that public pension systems, I think, are in a state of disarray today that they were not in 40 years ago. And it's also clear, particularly in inner cities, that they sort sort of the crisis in the classroom and inside these schools was much more serious. There was at that particular time a very weak charter school movement, a very weak homeschooling movement. Now all of these movements have gotten much stronger, and union activities have necessarily shifted, in part at least, from the bargaining table to the legislative front, because they are under very intense pressures to try to cut down the funding for any competitor that they happen to face, i.e. the charter schools are a perfect example. The city unions work extremely hard and diligently in order to basically upset them in every conceivable kind of way. And so the political dimension of unionization today is, I think, much greater than it was 40 years ago. And so in the Supreme Court, at the time, the four liberal justices knew that they were on shaky grounds with Scalia sitting with them on trying to win on the merits. And so they spent a lot of time trying to talk about stare decisis as one of these guiding variables. It is, I think, the case that, shall we say, that stare decisis is one of these values to which people adhere with great passion when the precedents are on their side, and one that they look to with great resentment when it turns out that they run the opposite way. And so if you want to consider some of the great reversals that we've seen, it's kind of instructive to ask, you know, how they came about and why. I mean, the most conspicuous of these, of course, is, I think, Brown v. Board of Education overruling Plessy and Ferguson, and that was, I think, a case of sort of general moral inevitability, where everybody finally saw by 1954 the evils of a system of segregation, which essentially at its peak was not regarded as that big an issue. 1896, when Plessy came down, all the way through the Woodrow Wilson administration, segregation was part of national life, but it wasn't the life and death issue because there wasn't much controversy about it. And then as the steam starts to move in the opposite direction, I think the justices were quite rightly to say that, you know, we can't abide this kind of system, half slave and half free, as it were, and they overturned it. You know, you get other kinds of decisions which are supposed to be radical differences, like Griswold in Connecticut, and there you start to say, well, virtually every state has decided to legalize contraception anyhow. So when you make it illegal to ban this in Griswold in Connecticut, what are you doing? Not very much. On the other hand, when you get to Roe v. Wade, where in fact you override a series of precedents which are in fact enforced in virtually every state, either through common law criminal situations or more often by statute, it's really a very big deal. And, of course, it was the liberals who drove that. And most recently, the Obergefell situation with respect to same-sex marriages was, of course, another huge reversal with respect to precedents. Again, dealing with a situation in which there's some degree of fluidity in the state level, but there was no strong constitutional support for the constitutionalization of the same-sex marriages under the Equal Protection Clause, and the same liberals who are sort of touting the virtues of stare decisis in this particular case are the ones who are quite happy to override it in the other. I don't put much weight on these arguments on either side. In general, I do think that stare decisis is a fine doctrine, particularly when everybody happens to support it, but the only cases in which it gets challenged are those in which they're genuine, deep philosophical decisions at the current time, and there you would expect to see people split on the merits. So when you start to then look at the particular merits, what are you supposed to say? Well, if you're somebody like myself who's essentially intellectually unreconciled to the constitutional revolution of 1937, what you say is a lot of things, which is that we should never be in this particular place in this particular situation in the first place. To the extent that any of these union protections are done as a matter of federal law under the National Labor Relations Act, the two strong objections are the commerce power objection on the one hand, and the sort of economic liberties objection on the other hand. I think both of these are perfectly valid. I'm still very much a believer in the late 19th, early 20th century synthesis on both of these points. Economic liberties preclude forced negotiations. The Commerce Clause does not extend to local activities, would be the way I put it. But of course, in dealing with many of these situations, what you do is you have state statutes which do the authorization so that the due process objections start to remain, but the Commerce Clause type objections disappear because of what's going on. If, in fact, you take this, I would also raise another objection, which I've talked about for a long time. I think, basically, Every public office is a public trust. I think the job of public administrators is to maximize value for the state at large. They cannot do that if they shower a monopoly favors through statutory authorizations upon unions or anybody else. A union, for my mind, is no different in this particular regard than any kind of industrial organization. Sweetheart contracts that give you wages above the competitive price and terms that no competitive market will sustain are, in this view, essentially out of kilter and should not be expected. So I would not even get to the First Amendment issues. I think the economic liberty issues and the government fiduciary duties issues are sufficient. What happens, of course, is today that you see people going in exactly the opposite direction. Economic liberties have been dumbed down to the point where they don't exist, but First Amendment liberties tend to be much stronger. And so what happens is the legal arguments migrate to where the standard of scrutiny that is given unto particular decision turns out to be the highest. And in this particular situation, that means that you're starting to go to the First Amendment and saying that the political association issues really matter. And given everything that we've said, that it turns out that the line between the political and the non-political speech is not tenable. Forcing people to contribute to a union that does things that are antithetical to themselves is, I think, regarded as a mistake. Michael Carvin, when he made his argument, I thought had a very nice phrase in which to encapsulate that. The unions start talking about free riders, i.e. people who get all the benefits to which they contribute none of the burdens, which is wrong given the fact that agency shop workers get fewer benefits. But he, Carvin, decides that, no, the better way to talk about them is as compelled riders, as people who have been forced to join into a cause in which they don't believe, who would be only too happy to have their emancipation. Many of them don't like unions for economic reasons. They think that they're going to be able to better under themselves under a meritocratic system than they are being locked into a union system, which raises the bottom and lowers the top and creates a kind of leveling effect, which is antithetical to advancements of people with genuine teaching skills and intellectual excellence inside the public school system. And I think it's a pretty good argument. The solidarity argument, of course, has always been used on the other side with respect to free riders. And Justice Scalia, writing about this issue some years ago, actually mused aloud that he thought that the free rider argument was pretty strong. And so what happens is his words were used against him in most of the briefs. Now, in many ways, let me just say that I think the most interesting things that I saw were briefs by the Buckeye Foundation, Robert Alton, I think the Mackinac Foundation, in which they actually ask a very simple question. What happens when you start having right-to-work laws? What does it do with respect to unions? And, you know, usually the story is that unions are going to find themselves massively deflated when these situations are put into place and that their ranks will be shattered. And certainly there are some cases in which that's true. There was a lot of difficulty for the members of the American Society dealing with state, municipal, and local and county workers in Wisconsin when Scott Walker basically undid the collective bargaining system there. But if you actually look around more comprehensively, it's a rather interesting and somewhat surprising story. And let me just briefly mention what the story is, because I think it's an encouragement. Well, the first thing we know is that since the Taft-Hartley Act, states that wanted to adopt right-to-work laws in the private sector were free to do so. And we see a consistent movement on the part of many states into that particular camp, none going in effect the other way. So that in recent years, we've seen Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin in the Midwest moving in that particular direction. And so then the question is, what happens to unionization? Well, in a place like Michigan, I think it actually goes up slightly. And the question is, what's the explanation for seeing this? And the way in which it's been put to me, and I'll repeat it now, strikes me as being rather appealing. The first thing to understand is, if, in fact, you don't have a right-to-work law, the union has a monopoly as against its potential members, and it could demand very favorable terms for itself. Once you give people the option to opt out, then all of a sudden the union has to compete with non-union organizations at this point, and what's going to happen is it's going to change the terms of trade. And sure enough, if you start to look at this, there are several effects that happen all at once. One is that the salaries to union officials start to go down now that they're facing competition. Second, the benefits that go to workers in the form of lower dues start to go up. And third, when you're an employer dealing with a union like this, knowing you're in an outright-to-work state, the negotiations that are going to take place are going to be rather different than in a circumstance where the union has a very dominant and controlled position. So at the end of the day, when you're going through all of this stuff, what happens is you have a slight rise in union membership, but the unions function in very different ways. And in fact, oddly enough, they are more competitive institutions than they are in other situations. Well, that seems to me to be a very powerful point explaining why it is that the usual rules of competition, in fact, ought to be done. And it's interesting that the conflicts here are not only between employer and union, they're also between unions and non-unionship or non-union membership. And in this latter particular capacity, the ability to opt out of unions and essentially makes employers and employees, rather than unions, more sensitive to the needs of the particular employees who are empowered with these sorts of options. How will this thing come out when the thing has gone through? Well, everything is going to depend upon the fifth nominee. If it's a person like Merrick Garland, an able man and generally a well-respected judge, he's going to vote liberal on this issue, as he has on virtually every other labor issue that has come in front of it. If it turns out that by some miracle, that's what it takes, the Republicans win the presidency, hold firm during the last months of the Obama administration, and control the Senate in 2017, you'll get a Scalia type. This case will surely come back, and the 5-4 result that everybody predicted before the untimely death of Justice Scalia will now turn out to be a reality. So that is the way I think in which this whole thing lines up. I've talked now for about 16 minutes or so, and so I think it's best to open the floor to questions.
We will do so. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to our first audience question, let me make a quick announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We've got one scheduled tomorrow at 2 p.m. This is another Supreme Court case. It will be argued tomorrow. It's the Hawks case, perhaps known to folks as the Waters of the U.S. case, that will be argued tomorrow in the Supreme Court. Our Teleforum is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern time. Today, of course, we're talking about the Friedrichs labor law case. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending. Let's go to the first caller.
First and only caller.
Yeah, hi. This is Henry Gass of the Christian Science Monitor.
Yes.
I was just wondering, I mean, do you expect to see more of these sort of 4-4 tie votes in for the rest of the term, sort of in the future?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on the Supreme Court docket. What I do is somebody tells me to read a case and to comment on it, and I do. But I think the answer to that question has to be yes. A case that I recently wrote about on defining ideas was the Little Sisters case. And if you go through that particular argument, I think it's pretty clear it's going to come out to be a 4-4 tie. Three of the liberal justices were just gunning for the lawyers on the other side, Paul Clement and Noah Francisco, from the opening gun. Justice Breyer, who will vote with them, did not have exactly the same approach on this question. He wasn't trying to attack them on what the authorizations required. He was saying, I just have this huge philosophical doubt about how it is we draw the line between religious liberties on the one hand and the collective rights of government on the other. And the general view is, if you don't know where to draw the line and you're a liberal justice, you will draw it in favor of the government in close cases. So I predict him to go that way. If you look on the other side, I think it's pretty clear that Roberts and Alito and Thomas, what do you know about Thomas, are pretty clear boats. Listening and looking at what Kennedy said, I think he goes the same way. So if you have any hot-button issue, immigration, I think, will be another. I think that you can expect a 4-4 vote. You know, in fairness, it's a complicated issue as to how we think about these things, but I have the following general sort of reaction. We had 4-4 votes in 1946 and 43. Five, when Robert Jackson trundled off to Nuremberg for about 14 months and nothing much happened. But it's a much more polarized court today, and it's a much more intensely followed court today. And it's a situation in which I think you're likely to get more of these 4-4 votes, and I think it's likely that they will occur in bigger cases. And then if you start looking at the political ramifications of this, and if you happen to be Mitch McConnell on the Republican side, you're thinking 4-4 votes, it's a lot better than losing everything 5-4. Because I think, Henry, it's not only the cases that are currently on the docket that you're worried about. It's what you've got to do is to go back to a bunch of other cases that were decided by 5-4 and see, quote unquote, whether or not these cases are going to be revisited. So just to mention a couple to you, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Lopez, which has tried to carve out this micrometer of state activity, which is not subject to federal government supervision under the Commerce Clause, that's going to disappear. The case is not liked by lower court judges. Lopez, too, has yet to come before the Supreme Court in a really decisive way. Nobody's going to expand it. They're going to contract it. And I think the liberal govs would say, this thing has shriveled. Now it's time for it to die. I think even more importantly, in terms of its practical consequences, a case like Citizens United, which was 5-4, where there's really, unlike the Lopez situation, a live and bitter dissenting group with respect to this opinion, I think that's absolutely toast. And you will start to see comprehensive regulation of various forms of speech activities by corporations and ordinary individuals and so forth, with Citizens United outside the shelf. And, you know, Supreme Court watchers who can find other great cases will point out the same thing. Now that I'm sort of on this free association run, if you ask me about the executive power and immigration case, a strong opinion written by Jerry Smith in the Fifth Circuit, I think what's going to happen is it's going to be 4-4, and everything's going to depend upon who the next justice turns out to be. As I like to say, there was a time when people kind of believed in muddling through on constitutional law. But the theoretical differences today are much sharper than they were even 20 or 25 years ago. To some people, originalism is salvation. To other people, it's a curse word, and it has to be exorcised. A man named Mitch Berman wrote this wonderful article called Originalism is Bunk. I think that's the whole title. I think you could figure out what side he comes on. On the other hand, you have the Originalism Institute and Boot Camp taking place with Mike Rappaport at the University of San Diego. So the cleavages have become just enormous on these issues. And so I think that you could expect some seismic switches to take place, and I think you could expect in the interim a fairly large number of 4-4 cases.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, Professor Richard Epstein, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few callers. We've got a couple questions pending now, so let's take another call.
Hey, good for this.
Hi, Dean. It's Stuart Gerson. I was ready to ask a question about the Free Riders case, which I will, but I was reading my email at the time, and I note that the Supreme Court has done something unusual in the Affordable Care Act contraception case. It's issued a 2-page order asking the Solicitor General if a settlement is possible, and it lays out all the terms of this prospective settlement. It looks like something that Justice Breyer would write, but it's an interesting twist. But my question with regard to the Free Riders case is that this is a Ninth Circuit case. Is it likely, Professor, that there's going to be a split in the circuits on this subject? How do you see the law developing?
I mean, let me just start with the first thing and go back to the second thing. I mean, what was so striking about the situation is that the liberal justices in the Little Sisters cases did not seem to think that there was much of a difference between a simple opt-out on the one hand and an authorization for the federal government to essentially tax the insurer or the third-party plan administrator of Little Sister and all of the other organizations. You know, the obvious settlement is give up on authorization, just allow the opt-out, and then everybody goes home.
And that's the proposal.
And that's the right proposal, because that's all that Little Sisters had asked for. I mean, I was actually very distressed by the argument, because I thought all of the hypothetical examples given by Justices Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Kagan basically thought that the distinction didn't matter. You know, if you just sort of opt out, it makes it easier for something to happen or harder for something to happen. If it makes it easier for the government to do something by opting out, that's the same thing as authorization. Catholic theology doesn't hold that, nor does ordinary common law, nor does any statutory definition of the complicity. And, you know, if I were doing this, that's exactly what I would do. I would just back off of this whole thing. I mean, it's a complete nightmare, because what's going to happen is if they write the opinion, what we'll then do is they'll order them to give the things. They won't sign the forms. What they'll do is they'll write something which says, we hereby opt out from the requirements. You go figure out the authorizations. And I think, in effect, you're just talking about a long-term guerrilla warfare, and there's no reason to do that whatsoever.
And well, I'm certain you're right about it, and indeed that's what it seems that the court has suggested, which is a direct relationship with the insurance companies that takes the religious organizations out of the picture.
Entirely, without having to do anything other than say, I opt out. And, you know, Noah Francisco, you know, he said this a dozen times. Clement said it a dozen times. I sat there wondering to myself, am I reading the same statute as everybody else? Am I reading the same briefs? So I hope that that happens, and I think it would be a highly salutary arrangement. Look, I think, in fact, that on this particular issue, the Democratic insistence that we force under the anti-discrimination laws religious groups to violate their conscience is profoundly anti-civil libertarian. And, you know, I'm strongly on the other side of this question, independent of my diehard opposition to the entire structure of the Affordable Care Act. I think they're separable issues. So that's it. Now, the other question is, talk about the Ninth Circuit. Well, what you have to do is to go back and read the Ninth Circuit opinion, and you realize that this thing is up for grabs somewhere else. The Ninth Circuit basically issued a one-paragraph decision saying there's no serious question that's raised in this particular case. We affirm on the authority of Abood and everything else before. Well, if you've got somebody who says, hey, there's nothing here that really matters, and then you sort of find out that the Supreme Court says, we're taking this case because we think there's something that matter, and then you have these huge public debates and these amicus curiae briefs, obviously some other party in some other state is going to do it. I mean, for example, people might go to the Eighth Circuit, because if you understand, I think in the Little Sisters situation, the Eighth Circuit decided to strike this thing down even though others did not. And if you want to figure out where to go again, you know, in a place like the Sixth Circuit where you have somebody like Jeffrey Sutton, he's not reluctant to go against these other characters. Remember, he was the one who wrote the opinion in the gay rights marriage case, same-sex marriage case, which essentially created a conflict between the circuits and forced the Supreme Court to take it. And so it's going to come up again one way or the other, and I would not be surprised if some of the more conservative circuits maybe come out in the opposite direction, and I think it's highly likely that there'll be divided opinions on this particular situation. What's happened to many people is that the huge uneasiness about public unions has gotten exponentially greater as it becomes quite clear that you can't solve the pension problem by any kinds of conventional means. And that's true in Illinois. If you read the paper today in California about minimum wage laws going up to $15 an hour in Bakersfield, which puts the city out of business and so forth, there's just a lot of uneasiness, even by responsible people on the left, that maybe we're just going a little bit too far. And I think that when it comes to this sort of, you know, zeitgeist, it's not going to say, well, there's no problem with respect to the forced union agency shop stuff just because there's something on the minimum wage law. I think the whole body of stuff is going to percolate through, and we will start to see conflicts taking place both across and within circuits.
We still have two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, Mark Walsh from Education Week. I cover the court for Education Week and some other publications. Professor, what should sort of the average American think make of a 4-4 decision where the lower court is affirmed, you know, but without an opinion? And because today you saw the unions reacting to this with all kinds of statements, like the Supreme Court today, I'm reading one of them, rejected a political ploy by the wealthy corporate special interests, and imputing a lot to a one line, or as I said to someone, reading between the line quite a bit that is not there. But if we're going to have more of these, how should people react to a case where the lower court is affirmed, but there's no opinion?
I think what happens is there's a standard view on this, whether the decision below was liberal or conservative, which is a 4-4 decision has no precedential value whatsoever, and the case will be re-argued. I think to say that the Supreme Court affirmed, i.e., on substantive grounds, that these are corporate kleptocrats taking advantage of it would be a false statement, even if it was a 5-4 vote upholding the thing because one of the conservative five happened to switch under these circumstances. I regard that as just fanning the fire as a kind of a complete and inexcusable form of intellectual irresponsibility. I thought the statement made on the other side was actually much more decent because the guy made up his opinion, said what he thought, said what he believed, and he says, we're going to examine and try to go back for a rehearing when there's a 9-member court so that we could hear the thing. And that's what the union should have said. I mean, look, my view about unionization, particularly in the public sector, is extremely harsh and completely uncompromising. I've always regarded monopoly unionization as being one of the great dangers to American civic life, and I think that that point has become more evident as the economic situations have become more parlous. The progressive dream does not work. It will never work under these circumstances. You need competition and education like you do in everywhere else, and if you're worried about monopoly, a government-entrenched monopoly is more dangerous than a private monopoly because there's no new entry and an easy way to stop it. And if you recall when we started to talk about the right-to-work laws, I stressed, in fact, that opting out of a union is a form of new entry into this particular market, which changes union behavior. And I believe, essentially, that the competitive model dominates the monopolistic model, both for firms and with respect to labor unions. And when you start calling your opponents capitalists and so forth, or oligarchs, or whatever word they want to use, I just regard that as argument by defamation, which has no particular substantive content to it. But my own view generally about most union statements most of the time is that they are the height of intellectual irresponsibility. I mean, I'm just saying this is an independent academic whose views are decidedly in the minority. I should just say for the record, if people wanted to know when did I form these views, the answer is probably between 1964 and 1968, when I was a student first at Oxford, then at the United States, and I managed to put together the English and the American cases on labor law and realize what a tremendous drag that they imposed upon the economy in both of these two countries. So this is long before the current political situation. By the time I entered teaching in 1968, I was a very determined foe of unions, and it was not on practical experience. It was on primarily theoretical grounds, all of which have proved to be accurate, I think, in the 48 years that have followed my entry into this business.
Okay. Thank you.
We are in the question and answer phase of our call. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've just got one question pending, then our lines will be completely open.
This is Bruce Cameron, and I'm a professor at Regent Law and on staff with the Right to Work Foundation. And I wanted to
I wonder what your views are. Good for you.
Oh, you wonder. Well,
Bruce, you could ask me two questions.
Well, I was going to comment on a question that was asked earlier. You were asked, is there a split in the circuits, and are there any other cases that are headed toward the Supreme Court? The answer is, the Right to Work people, I have about five of them, including one before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit that I argued in November. It's called Cerna versus Transport Workers Union, and that court's decision will be next in line to follow up on Friedrichs. And so the answer is there is another case that is immediately waiting at the Supreme Court, and it's a Railway Labor Act case, though, instead of a public employee case.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, it's amazing what knowledge does to people who have only sort of abstract thoughts. But let me just make a couple of comments on it. First of all, I'd be stunned for it to be anything other than that, because the issue, as you well know, is not simply a public union issue. It's also something that takes place in the private sector. For the rest of the group who may not know what the significance of the Railway Labor Act is, this is a statute which is independent of and prior to the National Labor Relations Act. It was first passed with respect to railway laborers in 1926. This is during the Calvin Coolidge presidency. when Harlan Fiske Jones was the national attorney general and so forth. So it was a Republican statute, and it essentially applied to railways because they were instrumentalities of interstate commerce, and before the transformation in 1937, they would be covered. In 1935 or so, the Railway Labor Act was extended to cover airlines as well. Now, the key difference between the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Labor Act is, essentially, in the Railway Labor Act, there are no strikes, but essentially, you only have to have concession bargaining. So it's an extremely rigid situation, and that allows unions, for example, to engage in feather bedding and keep the coal tender operators on diesel engines for 25 years after the steam engines that are run by coal have been long removed. So that statute, in fact, is the creakiest of the three statutes that we have, the public union statutes, the NLRA, and this. And so the right to work law in this particular case, I think, is exceptionally important. I don't see, Bruce, maybe I'm wrong, why there should be huge intellectual disagreements in these various areas. What happens is when you're dealing with public unions, it's the state kind of doing things, so it's not an umpire. It's now essentially a restrictor of speech and so forth. And the theory is that there's more direct engagement with public workers in public states than there is with respect to private unions. But in my own view, if Friedrichs comes out the way in which it might have if Justice Scalia had survived, then I think that right-to-work laws cease to be an option granted under the National Labor Relations Act in 1947 and sort of become a constitutional default provision. Do you agree with that, since you know the field better than I?
Well, I do agree with that. You know, the thing about the NLRA is that and the RLA is that the Railway Labor Act overrides state right to work laws. And so they don't apply to employees working under the Railway Labor Act. And that's the primary reason why the Supreme Court has said there's state action and thus a First Amendment argument for employees under the Railway Labor Act who oppose compulsory union fees.
Yeah, well, of course, that shows you the power of having differential regimes, because when the huge pressure for reform came after the strike wave of 1945, when the war was over, it all concentrated on the National Labor Relations Act, and it got you Taft-Hartley, but the Railway Labor Act of the transportation sector was not covered. It's obviously a smaller part of the overall puzzle, but it's extremely important, and now, you know, this is an education to me that one sees that you don't have the opt-out in that particular regime. It's a high-stakes kind of operation. Remember, the Fifth Circuit, I don't know what the panel was, but I would seem that you would have at least an even money of winning it there.
Well, let me tell you who the panel is. It was Edith Brown Clement. Jennifer Walker Elrod and the chief of the circuit, Carl E. Stewart. So I think Clement and Elrod are favorable, and they were favorable to me in oral argument.
That's the way I would read it. Again, you know, I'm more a professor than a judge reader, but, you know, what little I know about various judges on various benches, I would think that that's a fairly accurate prediction. I mean, I do think that the sort of mood on labor unions has very sharply changed in the United States. Let me just give it in another way. If you ask most people who work in employment law what they think the real area in which you have to move and move sharply is, most of them would not say labor law today. After all, labor unions are maybe 6% of the private sector. Most of them are much more keen on aggressive applications of the anti-discrimination laws, which essentially apply to all employers, whether or not unionized, so long as they have above, say, 15 or 17 workers. And that's where the pressure has been. And I think that, you know, given labor monopolies in these areas and the kind of disruptive force that they can start to have, there is less public support for unions, even in their decline, than there was earlier on. And I think, notwithstanding that I'm on the other side of this issue, I think if somebody were to try to propose, as I always do when I'm given half the chance, that we get rid of the basically Title VII in competitive labor markets, keeping it only for unions where there's a monopoly risk in question, I think that there's much more resistance to that than a rule which would tamp down on union kind of behaviors. So I think that the zeitgeist on the union side side is going very much in the opposite direction. I'll mention one other reason. Unions understand that they have a serious political problem. They understand that they can only extract monopoly rents if their employers have monopoly positions. And so what unions have to do now is engage in much more behavior off the bargaining table in an effort to solidify the position of the firms for which they work. And so that means they're keen on high tariff barriers of one form or another and very keen on entry barriers relating to zoning laws and so forth in various kinds of communities. Keep Walmarts out if it turns out that you're safe and your labor force turns out to be unionized. So I think that the political dynamics are rather different. And in the Fifth Circuit, my guess is that you will see a greater receptivity for a First Amendment challenge on associational grounds with respect to unions. And the Railway Labor Act, which is in many ways the worst designed of these statutes, is, I think, a perfectly plausible target for this kind of attack.
Well, I'm hopeful. Can I add one other point?
Unless it's a huge cube, I'm sure, go right ahead.
You had mentioned earlier the disadvantages of non-members who are represented by the California Teachers Association. The fact of the matter is that non-members are completely barred from having any voice or vote in their workplace conditions. So they're required to pay the $650 a year and not given any voice or vote in workplace conditions. If you're a religious objector to the union, you pay the full union dues amount, which is about $1,000 a year. You pay it to charity, but you still are barred from having any voice or a vote. So the unfair impact of this is worse for religious objectors.
Well, I mean, you know, that's going to produce all sorts of ambivalence as well, because the characteristic that we've seen with the Little Sister cases is it's quite clear that the attitude, bipartisan support for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that existed in 1993, you know, right after the dreadful decision of the late Justice Scalia and Smith case, that consensus is completely evaporated. And we now know that the ACLU has come out on the opposite side. There was a lot of sentiment, and you could see this reflected in the Little Sisters case, but saying that religious freedom extends to the things that start to take place in church. And in fact, in a rather misguided set of remarks, Justice Kagan, when she talked about this case, said, you know, that churches are really special and that we give them an exemption, whereas these other religious organizations like Little Sisters, they're not churches. We treat them somewhat more differently, even though if you look at common law rules or you look at the IRS charitable statutory rules, they all basically treat them as affiliated institutions like Little Sisters with the same kind of protection that they give otherwise. And the Democrats are taking a very sharp line against this kind of behavior. And, you know, I regard this as extremely troublesome, as a sort of rise of general intolerance. And if it carries over into the union area with respect to religious workers, I can see what's going on. I mean, the case that gives everybody huge difficulties to this day is, what do you think about Sherbert and Verner, where these Seventh-day Adventists, the Sabbatarian who wants to take off Saturday and not Sunday, can she get employment benefits on this? Justice Brennan says yes. Justice Stewart says no. Both opinions are extremely interesting, but it's very difficult to see to the bottom of the well on that case, which is, I think, one of the points that Justice Breyer made when he was giving his general screed about how difficult it is to organize church and state relations. I might add, of course, that the First Amendment does not speak about churches, and the Religious Reformation Act doesn't speak about churches. They speak about religion, which is a broader concept, and the exercise of religion involves more than the simple question of what kind of religious services you attend. I mean, you know, when you're Jewish and you observe the Kosreth, you're not doing it in synagogue, you're doing it in every day of your life.
I would hope that institutions don't have greater religious freedom rights than individuals. I mean, that suggestion seems to, and that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is such a compliment. Yeah, look, I mean, I am a small civil libertarian. I've always believed that religious liberties are a subset of general personal liberties. General personal liberties have surely been eroded since 1937, and now this particular island of religious liberties is being attacked on the grounds that you can't distinguish it. There was a brief written by some learned academics who said, you know, if you want to exempt these religious organizations from the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, it's an establishment of religion. If you have a sensible common law baseline, you don't have any anti-discrimination laws at all except in monopoly circumstances, and the issue goes away. But there is no question that the short-term and long-term progressive position is essentially to say that the Smith position, which Justice Scalia announced in 1990, really ought to be the law, notwithstanding their deviation from it when they supported in a bipartisan fashion RFRA in 1993. Any more questions, Dean, or can we all go home?
Let me check. Let me make another call for questions, a final call for questions, perhaps. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Got to push star and pound.
Going once.
I guess we've had our final question, Professor Epstein. Let me give you a chance, though, if you want to sum up, if you have a final thought you want to express.
Well, no, I think, in effect, what happens is that a lot of these cases, this one included, sort of reflect what I regard as the polarization of American thought. I plead guilty to being on one particular side, the losing side in terms of popular sentiment inside the academy, to be sure. But I think that the kind of attention that you've seen in Supreme Court arguments, the way in which the briefs have organized, it's really quite striking how different the practice of law is now than it was when I first entered the business. Even at the time of the Warren Court, you certainly had many great changes in the way in which law was organized, but there wasn't a strong rearguard action against them. What happened in American life is starting in the mid to late 70s and then reaching its crescendo, I think, in the Reagan years, there was all of a sudden an organized conservative presence, which included both religious elements on the one hand and libertarian economic elements on the other. It basically surged to the fore during the Reagan years, managed to tread water during the first Bush and the Clinton years, and it slowly has been in fairly serious decline with the rise of the liberals and progressives inside the academy. But the big difference between now and then is no matter what the sizes are in the academy, out there in the world, there are huge numbers of organizations, think tanks, religious groups, and foundations and so forth, which are on the other side. So it's different from the 1960s because it turns out both sides are fully armed and ready to go to the battle. In 1968 or 1966, when I was there, it was very much a one-sided situation. And I think this reflects itself in American politics today. I mean, there is a viable conservative movement which is not interested in restoring the New Deal, but interested in worrying about matters of growth and the forms of deregulation and lower taxation that might support that. If you look at the Democratic establishment from the president on down, they don't think of growth and freedom and low taxes as the dominant issues. They think of it as the form of inequality of wealth as being the driving force. And that gives rise to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And whatever happens in the general political arena is always going to be reflected in the judicial arena. That would be, I think, my final thoughts.
Well, if you'll indulge us, Professor, we do have one more question. We've got some time. Can we take another question?
Yes, we can. I mean, I'll charge double for this one.
I appreciate that. I'll make it triple, but here we go.
Yes, hi there. My name is Bobby McMillan, and I apologize if this may have been covered earlier, but I'm wondering how likely you think a rehearing is, that whether or not that may be granted in this case or some of the other 4-4 splits we're likely to see.
Well, I think all of these cases are so important that they will be reheard at one time or another. If not with the current parties, then was suggested coming with another case raising the same kinds of issues. Look, the Supreme Court has a huge role in American life today. It's not always on constitutional grounds. Sometimes it's on statutory or regulatory grounds, but it really doesn't matter. When the stakes are high, the Supreme Court will not stand aside. And when they have a full complement, these cases will be taken up. You need only 4 for certiorari. Somebody's going to be able to get 5 votes on this thing. And you can just be sure as shooting that the major cases will all be back, and that the same parties will align perhaps with even greater fervor when that starts to happen. I mean, the idea that somehow or other the court is going to slip into the distance, I think, is a mirage. I think that the current situation is here to stay as long as the current configuration of the political arena is like it is, and there is no dominant ideology in the United States. And generally, when you have two groups of roughly equal strategy, of equal strength, fighting with one another, it's going to be an extremely tough fight because nobody's going to back off. Each side is going to think that the stakes are so high that it has to muster everything that it has on its command in order to win this particular struggle. So, I mean, those of us who are Supreme Court commentators, I think we can look through it to golden years because there's going to be so much of this stuff going on.
And I guess just looking at the mechanics of Rule 44, if it's going to be this specific case, these specific parties, you've got to have five justices. So somebody from the liberal side, I suppose, has to come over too. Do you expect that to happen?
Well, when you get nine, it will happen. Because the winning side, and they will know who they are, will always want to bring this thing up. So if you get another conservative, by God, they'll bring it up. And what they will do is they will overturn the Abood type situation. If you get another liberal, they'll bring it up and they will affirm it because they're dangerous in the other circuit. So I think, in effect, if you didn't have the 4-4 tide, all roads would lead to Rome, and Rome would be a decision by nine members on the Supreme Court. The interim hiatus, I think, doesn't change the long-term dynamic. These cases will be back one way or another. They're not going to go away.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure.
We will have to let that be the final word now. I want to thank Professor Richard Epstein again. He's of New York University, Hoover Institute, and the University of Chicago as well. Professor, thank you for joining us here today, especially at such short notice. Thanks to our audience also for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about another Supreme Court case, this one being argued tomorrow, not decided. It's the Hawks Waters of the U.S. case tomorrow at 2 p.m. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.